Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's Sunday, October 2nd, 2016. Welcome to episode 138 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computing news, nostalgia, and collecting. I'm your host, Ken Gagne, and joining me today is that other Apple II user in Boston, Paul Hagstrom. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Ken. How are you?
I'm fine. I would ask you how the weather is, but I have a pretty good idea. I'm sitting next to the window.
Yep. Yeah. Winter's coming. Summer's over.
Isn't there usually a season in between those two?
I don't know. It's pretty sudden here, but I can barely see the window, though, through my stack of, like, Apple monitors and stuff. So
that is a problem that I suspect may be unique to you. Nobody quite has a collection like yours. Also joining us today, we are experiencing a Jack attack all the way from across the ocean, Mr. Jack Nutting. Hi, Jack.
Hey, Ken.
How are you today?
I'm pretty good. I'm happy that a little over a week ago, I actually got my pocket chip that I ordered a while ago.
Ooh.
And it's pretty cool. It's everything that it says on the tin it's supposed to be. Well, it doesn't come in a tin. It comes in a cardboard box. The thing is, it's a little bigger than I imagined in a way, because the screen is like the size of an iPhone 4 or 5, maybe. But then it's got a keyboard and stuff. So, like, overall, it's kind of like the dimensions of an iPad mini almost, but then quite a bit thicker. And the keyboard is like this little, it's like little membraney buttons. I don't think I'm being too cruel if I say it's like a tiny Atari 400 keyboard in terms of how it feels. It's like you got to press these things and it's kind of like you can't really type on it. But
a kind of popping, pushy feel as you go down on
yes.
the key press. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, but it's pretty cool. I think the only real drawback of that, like, because it's fine. You can put SSH on this. You can connect to it from your laptop, whatever, install things. It's running Linux, and that's great. The only thing is that all the built-in games that are in Pico 8 in there, they want to use the arrow keys to move around, and the arrow keys are arranged in a little sort of diamond cluster. But it's not at all like a D-pad. You can't just sort of slide your thumb around. You have to slide and push and slide and push, and you can't do diagonal because you can't push two at once. And I don't know. I mean, it's cool. I don't want to say it's not cool, but it's not like wow, now I can play all these games in a great way on this thing, because the keyboard control is not really what you need. So
does it? It has a like a USB connector though, right?
Yes, it does. So I think you actually plug in external keyboards and probably mice and maybe even like a joypad controller. I'm not really sure. So I honestly haven't had enough time to like test it out, but so far I'm very pleased with it, I have to say.
You might like it, just to point out, if you get a Fignition and play with that for a little bit, then you might like your keyboard a little better, because the Fignition has it looks like 8 keys that you cord to type. also, hi, Michael.
Yes, hello, Michael, calling us all the way from the land of kangaroos, Vegemite, and funnel web spiders. It's Michael Mulhern.
Hi, guys. Let me just go sweep a few of those spiders out the door. Friendly.
I don't know how you can live in a country that is so set on killing you.
you get used to it, and most of the time it's only the tourists.
I suppose you learn to live in mutual respect of the other inhabitants of your continent.
Oh, yeah, there's lots of creepy, crawly things. You know, there's spiders, snakes, lizards, politicians. You put up with them all.
Oh, my. Are we sure we're not talking about the United States?
That's Saturday Night Live full time.
Oi, oi. Moving on, before we alienate all of our listeners and each other, let's get right to this week's host topic. There were a variety to choose from, so we democratically allowed me to dictate which would be the topic this week. And that topic is, I have several websites that I maintain. Most of them run in WordPress. I do some website management and maintenance as my day job. And especially at that day job, one of my responsibilities is to make sure that the websites are accessible. And that means that a variety of users and visitors to the site, regardless of their abilities and capabilities, can access the site, whether they live with color blindness or full blindness or they are hard of hearing. However, there are other audiences that we should perhaps consider outside of our day jobs where it's not legally mandated. And by that, I mean retro computing users. I saw somebody on Facebook recently asking, how accessible is Facebook from an 8-bit computer? And somebody said, if you access the mobile version of the site, which is m.facebook.com, it's a little bit more accessible. There's a little bit less JavaScript, which some 8-bit computers and even 16-bit computers might have trouble with. I also have been adding SSL certificates to a lot of my personal websites because those are now free via the Let's Encrypt project. However, if you're using Spectrum Internet Suite, or SIS, on the Apple IIgs, that software is not capable of accessing SSL encrypted websites, which begin with HTTPS. And so, therefore, I withheld adding an SSL certificate to my Apple II website, which is apple2bits.com, or .net, rather. And so I'm wondering, do we need to consider these audiences when crafting online content? Certainly, there are web standards nowadays that you can be fairly confident your site will work the same, whether it's in Firefox, Chrome, Safari, or Opera. Do we also need to take into account Lynx, Spectrum Internet Suite, software that is running under Contiki or Marinetti on the Apple II, or whatever other platforms might be out there? What do you all think? Let's start with Paul.
Well, I think basically it's hopeless. mobile site was a good kind of go-to for, you know, the main things you want to visit because they would be scaled down because they were expecting you to be using, you know, like an iPhone 1 or something. But it's gotten to the point where the computer on the phone is, you know, can run, you know, like emulators in a browser. You know, it's that the phones are too sophisticated now. I'm kind of fearing that the mobile versions are just going to be smaller. They're not going to be any less taxing. And I also think that it's pretty hard to get away from encryption. So it does sort of seem like, you know, it's going to become more difficult or impossible to tweet and use Facebook and stuff like that from your, you know, like command line computer. But a lot of times that has been handled by you know, putting some sort of, like, depends on how you get on the internet, but if you're getting on with some sort of intermediate, like Raspberry Pi or something, you could conceivably filter, you know, sort of filter out JavaScript stuff in the middleman there. But I don't know. Anyway, I guess my main thought is, I think it would be nice. I don't think it's going to be possible to really like continue using the web in any serious way as the web gets more and more demanding, and, you know, sort of client side stuff gets more and more the norm. But certainly anything where you're expecting something sort of retro, so you have things to download, or you have like a news site about the Apple II or whatever that you can directly point to and figure out, you know, some server that will let you not use encryption. So I don't know. I guess, that's basically all I had to say about it. I think I think we can maybe do that with some targeted things, but I think it's kind of hopeless to think in the future we're going to be able to make our main blogs accessible that way.
That is true. Certainly development for classic hardware and software continues, but I think it is not occurring at the same pace that modern telecommunications efforts are developing, and there may not be a way for us to keep up. Let's get a take from Michael.
Yeah, well, I've never really thought it was that important to make the websites retro accessible. I like the idea of having some servers available where if you do have that ability on your machines to actually go out and taste the wild internet on your 8-bit, but I used to be involved in quite a few retro-ish forums where people were always complaining about trying to access banking sites and trying to do their day-to-day work on retro computers. And I'm talking more about the early Macintoshes. That was something that interested me, but less so now. But that was more that where people were trying to eke out that last little bit of everydayness from their machines. But back to true machines, true 8-bit machines, I think it's more of a, to me, an exercise in connectivity, a good project piece. But it's not something which really, I think, well, for myself and others, it's not really something that we've really got to get out there. It's like, can I get my System 80 bringing up a website on for support, or can my MicroB get onto Facebook? It's something which is a great little project exercise. And as Paul said, I think most of this could be done with some kind of retro proxy in between, so a Pi. Filtering or stripping down the websites that you're looking at to either provide a text-only rendition so as to get past, as you said, the security certificates, HTTPS websites. But, you need a little bit of processing power if you're going to go and retrofy the images, and that's going to be quite a lot of effort. But I think the best way to approach it would be with some kind of retro proxy intermediary.
Okay, thank you for that technical explanation. How about Jack?
Well, I think that retro accessibility is in a way something to strive after, in the same way that accessibility in general is something to strive after. So, for instance, and I think these kind of go hand in hand. If you have a website that is easy for someone who is blind to access with software that reads their screen for them, chances are that's also going to be easier to deal with on an old computer and an older style browser. I think the same things that plague someone trying to use an 8-bit or 16-bit computer with modern websites with a lot of JavaScript and stuff are probably a pain in the neck for someone who is blind or has other accessibility problems with a lot of these websites. And I think there's a distinction that has to be made, though, between, like, a lot of websites historically have been what either are or seem to be static content, right? It's just like you load a page and there it is. More and more as time goes by, things are turning into actual applications, like something like Gmail or even Facebook nowadays. It's just a big JavaScript application running in a page. It's not really, you've gone away from the idea of links between one page to another, which inherently makes it difficult to deal with anything that is not a modern browser. And so I think some of those things are just never going to be, like, we're never going to be able to convince Facebook to make things better for us in that sense. And I think what Paul's saying about the mobile versions of websites inevitably getting heavier is also going to be the case. I think the only mitigating factor there might be the fact that there is still a huge portion of the world where mobile still means something like a 2010 era feature phone. That it's not something that is, there are a lot of people who still don't have smartphones, and Facebook still wants to reach those people. I'm thinking about Asia, Africa, where it's a whole different economic situation. So I think that some of these things will continue to work reasonably well for a while for us, but some things are just inevitable. But when it comes to our own websites, like if I'm building something that is a blog and I want it to, my general thought is that I would like the web to work kind of like it worked from the beginning, that, you have resources represented by URLs and you can move between them and render them however you want on the device you're on. And so I think that, like, making sure your site works on links if possible, is great. And that will probably, if it works on Lynx, it's probably going to work pretty well for people who are blind. It'll probably work even decently for someone running a retro computer. But it will, you know, in all cases, it's not possible.
You bring up a very good point that that which benefits one group of users will likely benefit many groups of users. That's a very good point that there are multiple reasons to be exploring these features. As for myself, like I said, I did not enable SSL on Apple2bits.net, but I did enable it on juice.js, which produces the somewhat annoying juxtaposition that you can't order the world's last remaining Apple II print publication from an Apple II. However, you could never read Juice.js on an Apple II either because it's a print publication. And so, you know, and I want to enable my customers to be able to make their purchases safely and securely. And so I think that's more important than being able to access it from Lynx, for example, which right. I think you can do. It's just whatever. So great. Thank you for that thoughtful discussion. Now let's move on to the items of interest and the news. Our lead item this week comes to us from Jack. Jack, take it away.
Well, there's a story that many of our listeners have probably seen somewhere on the interwebs in the past couple of weeks or in the past few days. It's a story about a battered and filthy Commodore 64 that's been running in an auto repair shop in Poland for 25 years. There's a nice picture of this thing. It is incredibly filthy and has a floppy drive that is equally filthy. And a screen, a green screen, that is also equally filthy. One of the things clean in this picture is the modernish phone sitting next to it. It's somehow connected to something that is driving. It's got some software that balances drive shafts and looks horrible, but still works, apparently. I think the interesting thing is that, to me, one of the interesting things is that there's this computer, and it's got a floppy drive, and there's just filth everywhere. And I wonder, like, how this floppy drive is doing and how the floppy inside there with the software is doing. Like at some point this thing is going to fail because it's clearly just a filthy, filthy environment. So, but so far so good, apparently.
Yeah. One has to wonder, you know, it says it's still, you know, it's still working, it's still doing its thing or whatever, but I wonder, has it been repaired? You know, has it ever been cleaned? Has it been replaced? It's just the idea of putting the drive head on a floppy, spinning around under it in that dirt storm.
Yeah. Mm. I guess the one saving grace is that it looks like you can see that the little door, the little door latch on the floppy is open. So I'm guessing maybe they fire it up with the floppy in and then take the floppy out and put it away in something that's cleaner. But still, you're going to get dirt flying around. It's going to be landing on the drive head anyway, and it will hit the floppy later. I don't know.
Yeah, it's so much like grind the data off the media.
Yep. So, yeah, anyway, the article that we're linking to is the only article that I've really seen about this, but I've seen it in a dozen places, and we've got an email about this from a dozen listeners, which is not a problem. Not complaining. Thank you, everybody. But unfortunately, the article it links to on this hothardware.com is just not very detailed. Like, it's just kind of like, it says, hey, here's a thing. Here's an old computer. And then it's got four paragraphs about the Commodore 64 in case no one knew what it was. So it would be interesting to get to know more details about this. Like, you know, like you said, had they repaired this? Had they replaced it? What is the story? But we don't have it.
Yeah, I'd like to know about the unit it's connecting to. How's it connected? How's the protocols handled? What do you do with the floppy disk? I'm just zooming on the picture here, and I'm kind of seeing that the floppy disk is actually in there.
It is in there. You're right.
Mm.
The door's open, but it's still in there.
And then the whole story about computer hygiene, I just love it for a story that we've got a retro machine that is still doing a day job. So many of its brethren have fallen by the wayside, but this one's still doing its job.
And it's, you know, kind of reading between the lines a little bit because it doesn't have very much detail, but it does. It says the computer uses a sinusoidal waveform generator and a piezo vibration sensor, and so I'm assuming that at least part of the reason that this is still in use is that that you couldn't just like use a Raspberry Pi or something emulating it because there's, you know, it's connecting to hardware and it works still. So, but it does sort of seem like this would be otherwise awfully simple to just run on you know, like a chip or something.
Yes, but you'd have to know how to do it, and quite possibly this may have actually just been set up for the workshop, and obviously there's no one on the other end of the support phone anymore, and to find out for a replacement. But just zooming in on the screen, it just looks like a basic programming program running. At the top of the screen, there's a break-in line number, and then they get ready. They just type run, and they seem to be off again on another session. So,
Right, but it is. But I think it is a hardware interface, though, somewhere.
My brother used to have to keep running older DOS-based serial machines, both for the serial type connection back to the hardware he was running, and the software itself only ran in DOS. It wouldn't even run in a command line session under an early version of Windows. So now there's quite a lot of hardware, as you said, hardware interfacing out there that still relies on the older machines. And unless you've got someone who can sit down and first off get time to work on the machine and test it, and then there's always that thing about will it work exactly the same as the old system did?
Well, and I mean, to be fair, that thing that's sitting next to you with the knobs and stuff, I mean, that's probably even older, so what the heck.
It's quite possibly is older than the Commodore.
So the stuff still works, they can still get the fees from the customer. So
just keep your fingers crossed that next Monday when they come into the workshop, it keeps working.
I would love to put together for Juice.js a article about Apple IIs that are still being used in today's businesses. We did a cover story a few years ago by Randy Brandt about a clock shop, I believe, in New York City that was still using Apple II, in which Randy helped them convert to a web-based system, I believe. I know that Apple II, the Commodore 64 in this story, they can't be the only ones still out there. But, of course, they are becoming harder and harder to find as the years go by, and these hardwares do fail or just get replaced with more accessible machines. But it was great to see that this machine is still out there. Michael, you've had plenty to say. Why stop now? Let's hear some more about the new Microbee.
Well, talking about replacing old hardware with new, what is happening here is Microbee, a classic Australian technology company, has announced that they're creating a new retro Microbee. So it's still going to be Z80 processor running at a blindingly fast 10 megahertz. It's got all the interfaces that you want, and basically comes in a kit ready to assemble. Now, they released a teaser on Facebook. There's a link to their website, and looks like quite an interesting machine. Not enough information out there yet. As they say, more information will be provided and a launch date set as development progresses. So somewhere between prototype, not really vaporware, I'm really looking forward to it. It says it has an Arduino compatible expansion shield option to fit onto the mainboard. So, as they say, yet to be prototyped. So, there seem to be some great ideas here for connecting a retro machine, still with the classic architecture, but more capable of potentially dealing with a modern day environment. I wonder if it can possibly do the job of a Commodore 64 that might have been talked about previously. But it's one of those things. Looks interesting. I hope it comes to fruition. I'll be putting my money down if it becomes a product, and if they do have an Arduino expansion shield for it, that'd be a great way of getting some extra connectivity. Lots of little lovely devices that could be connected by that shield connector. SD card operation, floppy disk emulation. So you've got your classic computer, but you're using a modern day storage media, which in itself is a great idea. And of course, it has a beautiful, beautiful looking keyboard.
Mm-hmm. So two questions about that. One is what they're showing right now lacks a case. Do you know if they're planning on making the case so it actually is near indistinguishable
Funny
from a real
about
one?
That, yeah, I haven't seen anything about that. I would really love it to have an option of purchasing a case that goes in it. Even if it was compatible with the existing cases, you got issues where in the picture you can see the SD card cage. So obviously there's not going to be a slot for that. So you'd need to have access to put that in. So I would love a micro B styled case so that it could sit here beside a real micro B. And at first glance, you wouldn't be able to tell that it's a modern day machine until you sat down and used it. But I can't see anything about it. It was one of the first things I looked for as well. I think it'd be great.
It looks like it does have it says floppy disk drive interface option, which means I think that they expect you could plug a real floppy into this thing, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that'd have to. I can't see them getting any new floppy drive mechanisms for that. So that would be, to me, more along the lines of you've got an original book drive or something along those lines that you could actually hook up to the new B.
Yeah. Actually, I think in the Facebook demo, it looks like that's what they've done in this picture. So.
Yeah, well, we'll include a link to both the website and the Facebook link.
Excellent.
Might be a good way of doing it.
Look for those show notes at rcrpodcast.com. Paul, you have a news item here that is right up your professional alley.
Yeah. I don't actually know if this fits in this podcast or not, but I saw it linked to at some point. This is the strange Victorian computer that generated Latin verse called the Eureka. And apparently this was in July 1845. It was exhibited. I'm not sure actually what it was, but it was in London's Egyptian Hall. This is the novelty of the summer. And basically it's a big sort of, a wooden cabinet thing that would present to you Latin poetry, so a Latin hexameter verse, and it's a mechanical device, so it's a computer of a sort, it's a computer ancestor of a sort or whatever, but it is a natural language generation machine, basically. several drums. It has words on them, and it arranges them such that they will be, they'll scan properly, providing things like, and I'm not going to try to read the Latin, but, Latin lines that mean like military camps foretell many battles abroad, and apparently it's, there was some thought put into it so that the words on each drum were sort of similar in meaning so that you would get sort of sensible sounding things. So it's a early Eliza or something. But anyway, yeah. So it's I thought it was kind of neat, just because I have actually recently been thinking a little bit about natural language generation problems and things, because I'm attempting to teach a course on computational linguistics at the moment. So, and this was interesting because 1845 is a long time ago, but
just a little.
Apparently, Charles Babbage and Ada Lovelace may have seen this machine and been inspired by it. There's actually also, there was a brief mention in this article of another thing that was a proto-computer called the Polyharmonicon, which is a machine that composed polkas, but I couldn't find much more about that, so only a couple of references in, very short news stories about, the Queen coming to see it or something, but I would like to know more about the Polyharmonicon. But at any rate, I thought it was kind of cool. There's some nice pictures of it. And at the moment, it had been sort of floating around for a while, but I think it made it back to, I believe it's being restored right now and will soon be back into a place that can be seen. But there are nice pictures, modern pictures as well of this. So check it out.
Excellent. Anybody want to respond to that? Anybody have anything else to say? Any Latin lovers in the audience?
Latin lovers.
Like Paul, I am not going to massacre the Latin that was presented in there. But this is the sort of stuff that I love. So this is really generation zero for computers, mechanical computers. So I would really like to see this. Looks like I've got to do a trip to the UK sometime.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, moving on, I have a news item, which is that this past Wednesday, I was invited to the movies by Twitter user C64, and he and I saw a documentary that just came out on September 16th, that being Silicon Cowboys. I honestly didn't know anything about this movie. It doesn't have a great IMDb rating, but it does have an excellent score on Rotten Tomatoes. All I knew was that it was about a part of computer history that I don't know anything about. And so I thought, well, this will be an opportunity to learn something new, because pretty much my history familiarity is limited to Apple. And this documentary is not about Apple, it's about Compaq, which is, of course, a hardware company founded by three former Texas Instruments employees who decided to make their own laptops and desktops and portables and luggables. Ultimately, in 2003, they merged with HP, and that was pretty much all I knew, was that they were just another brand of PC clone. But this documentary really underscored just how important they were in opening up that market and the relationships that they had with companies like Microsoft and Intel. There was also a lot of footage used from the TV show Halt and Catch Fire, which I'm a big fan of, because that show was apparently heavily inspired by the true story of Compaq. So there were interviews with some of the scriptwriters from that show and clips from the show and how they paralleled real life. The documentary ends in 1993 when I believe one of the three co-founders, actually by that point all three co-founders had left the company, and the movie is based on a book written by one of those co-founders. So I guess it's not so much Compaq's story as it is his story, or at least Compaq's story as long as he was around. It sort of just ends the movie on a footnote saying 10 years later they merged with Hewlett Packard. But nonetheless, I thought it was a really good movie. I learned a lot, and I am glad I went and saw it. It's available not only in theaters, but also streaming. It had a simultaneous online release, so you can catch it at siliconcowboys.com, I believe is the URL. I'm sorry, siliconcowboysmovie.com, and there it'll link to iTunes, etc., etc. Has anybody else seen or heard from this movie?
No, I haven't seen it, but I just love the backstory that an Apple guy and a Commodore guy went and saw a movie about a Compaq. So,
hey, we're open-minded here. We're open to all retro computing types.
That's right.
That's
what I think is great.
It's not the Apple Computing Roundtable here.
No, definitely not.
Every now and then I need to present evidence against the theory that I'm an Apple snob. So there you go. I went to see Silicon Cowboys.
Yeah, so that should hold you over for a while now.
Yeah,
at least a week.
It definitely looks like a movie to see. Have to see when it's going to escape the U.S. and get out this way.
It definitely looks like something I would like to check out at some point.
Yeah. In theaters and on demand September 16th, so it looks like I'll have to figure out where I can get it via online.
Yes, given that September 16th was 2 weeks ago.
Here, available on Apple iTunes. Okay, fine. Looks like I know what I'm going to be watching next weekend.
All right, well, in that case, let's move on to our next news item, that coming from Jack.
Yeah, so I saw this thing posted on the Atari 8-Bit Computers group on Facebook. We will have a link to this. I don't know how linking to Facebook works. You may have to be a member of this group to see this, and that may require that you actually seek membership and have to wait for someone to grant it to you. Maybe it may be a private group or one of those things that you have to sort of apply. I'm not sure. We'll see. We'll do our best. But what this is kind of cool. So the Atari 8-bit computers, they have the SIO port, which is a serial interface port, and it's a 13-pin connector. If you imagine that if you imagine something like a DB13, if there's a DB13, but much bigger and fatter and weirder, that's basically it. And the parts for these are sort of almost impossible to source, especially in large quantities nowadays, because no one is making them, and there are a few sellers that have them, but you can't buy that many of them typically, because they're afraid people will hoard them. I don't know. So for people who are making things to connect their Ataris to other devices, this is sort of a challenge. Because there are a number of like devices for connecting SD cards to an SAO port or plugging an SAO port straight into a PC, either through a serial connection or a USB connection or Bluetooth or what have you. So the guy who posted this is someone called Ray Atergan. I'm probably mispronouncing his last name. Otherwise known as Atari 8Wares on AtariAge.com, where, incidentally, he has apparently been banned some time ago. I don't know the story. I don't want to have a drama about this. But he posted on Facebook anyway, and he had some oblique comments saying, oh, well, I was on AtariAge before, and people didn't like me doing blah, blah, blah. But what he's come up with is a cool thing. So his idea is, so the port on the Atari computer is like a male DB13-ish port, which means that it's a socket with pins sticking out. And he said, well, okay, we can't get the female part for this very easily, so what I can do is I'll just fabricate a card with an edge connector with contacts, 7 on one side and 6 on the other side. Is that right? Yes, 7 plus 6, 13.
Uh-huh. I'll get my calculator out.
So you can slide this in between the two rows of pins and use that to build devices. And so he's used this to build an SAO to PC device for connecting your Atari to a PC, and he's selling some of these. And it's just sort of cool, and I had never seen this or thought of this. He did say somewhere this is not his idea. He'd seen it on some kind of prototyping board for something before, but it seems to be an interesting way to plug things into an Atari without having to deal with this big, weird cord that is hard to find if you're building your own devices. Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, it seems interesting, and I just never seen this solution before, and I thought it seemed pretty cool.
Yeah, I must admit, I've never seen an edge connector into a standard DB socket either, but it's elegant in its simplicity. I just wonder how good the traces on the board will hold up to repeated use.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does seem like there's probably... It's probably better to use a real thing, but if you don't have a real thing, this does seem like it's pretty sneaky solution. Even apart from, just making the contacts safe, it does seem like that's going to be an issue.
If it hasn't had a socket in it for any period of time, those pins can get easily out of alignment. And even just rough use of the socket, I've seen so many of them with the pins bent over. But yeah, sure. It's definitely a better than I don't have a socket to build the cable to do it. I think it's elegant in its simplicity.
And I do want to say that also, I believe, and I haven't gone and measured, but I believe that the pins on these SAO ports are a bit thicker than the pins on like a DB9 or DB15 male connector. Okay. So they're probably less likely to bend out of shape than they are on a DB9 port, which I've seen a lot of those bend as well. So, I don't know, it remains to be seen, and I haven't tried it, and the guy who came up with this, he said it seems to be solid, and it seems to be, it seems to connect and not come loose, and... So far, so good. So,
yeah,
worth checking out if you're thinking about this.
Yeah, I wonder if, and just looking at this, I wonder about other if I can imagine the pins spreading apart, but maybe because they are so thick in this, it wouldn't matter. But you could imagine you could make it. You could put a top and a bottom plastic layer there too to help guide the pins into the right place without actually making a full female connector.
Yeah, that's true.
So, yeah. Anyway, that's cool. It's once you see it, it does sort of seem like, oh, of course.
Yeah.
Yep. Very cool. All right. Now for our news story that is completely unbiased, in which the speaker has no stake whatsoever. Michael.
Oh, I thought you must have been skipping mine then. No, this is just a plug for the Retro Challenge. It's now underway. October has started all over the planet. So there are 30-ish entries already. I'll supply a link to the actual list of entries. A clarification or public service announcement. I have an entry in this, but as I'm also one of the judges, I can almost guarantee you that this judge won't be judging his own, and I doubt any of the other judges will be judging it. So regardless of its success or otherwise, I don't think I'm going to win. But The important thing is the other 29 entries are all looking great. Everyone has got their blogs started, and there are some very interesting ideas, hardware and software, out there. So there's still time to put a late entry in. There were 4 late entries received just after the start of the competition. So, join in and make my life a lot more fun and enjoying as I monitor all of these projects, make my notes, and then help out John as the head judge and coordinator of the Retro Challenge, and still see if I can find some time to actually get my little programming exercise done. So, I won't go into any detail on those entries. I think I'll just save that for another day. Join in. It's a lot of fun. The main fun is being involved and seeing if you can get that idea all done in 1 month. So.
Well, on that note, if I can go off script, I'd like to include a plug for another competition that is currently ongoing. That is the Annual Interactive Fiction Competition, or IF Comp, which is ongoing at the moment. I believe this is the 22nd year. The games have already been submitted. If you want to write a game, a text adventure for the 22nd annual IF Comp, it is too late for that, but it is not too late to be a judge for this year's competition. All the games have been posted to the website, and it looks like there are 58 of them. 58 original brand new text adventures, the vast majority of which can be played right in your web browser without installing any sort of software. And you can go to ifcomp.org, download all the games in a 212 megabyte zip file, and just start playing. Judging is open to anybody. You have to rate at least 5 of the games out of 58 in order to be considered a judge, so you can't just vote for your one favorite and then walk away. So no ballot stuffing here. But this is a great opportunity for people who just want to try something new and have their voices heard, and in a way that's probably more constructive and meaningful than leaving a review on Amazon or IMDb or Metacritic. So yeah, check that out at ifcomp.org to help support the future of interactive fiction. Of course, we mentioned on a previous episode of this podcast that I had interviewed one of the co-founders of the Interactive Fiction Technology Foundation, which is a new nonprofit that has taken over the organization of IF Comp, so that's why this is on my radar. But yeah, I think it's great that this competition is still ongoing after all these years. I guess I should also mention, in the interest of full disclosure, that I'm the editor of JuiceGS, which has donated a subscription to the magazine as one of the prizes, which it has been doing for the last 5 years or so. And the same guy wins every year and chooses that as his prize from the prize pool. So we have a subscriber who's been getting every issue for the last 5 years and has never paid. But that's okay.
I thought it was a plea for someone else to win.
No, I think it's great that there is such continuity in this event, that there are people who aren't just drive-by game designers who are trying this once and only, although I'm sure there are those too who just want to try something new and see if they're any good at it. But there are people who enjoy entering this competition every single year, and you get to see the evolution of their games. Lead Light, which was a game designed on the Apple II by Mr. Wade Clark, was in this competition, I think, about 5 years ago. And he won the Golden Banana Award, I believe, because his game was not playable from the web. It was not written in Inform or Twine. It was written in Eamon for the Apple II and was only playable on an Apple II. And people who actually went through the trouble of getting his game to work in an emulator really seemed to like it. And everybody else was really frustrated at all the technical and software and hardware limitations, specifications, and requirements that they had to jump through just to play his game, as if it was almost some sort of a meta game. And so his award was, it was the game with the widest diversity in scores, which I'm not sure is necessarily something to be proud of, but that was his to go home with. Anyway, that is the end of my spiel. Sorry for taking us off script. Let's get back on script with our final closing news item.
This is such a tight ship. I don't see.
I know,
you
right?
You ruined it.
I know. We all run it so neatly. So let's get back on script. Paul, tell us about, and be sure to pronounce it correctly, this particular game.
Yes. Kevin Savitz posted on Atari Age that he had gotten some discs from Jordan Mechner for this game, K-Ray TK, something like that.
I loathe you.
No, it's Karateka. I don't care how anyone else pronounces it. There's a GIF of the discs here. So Jordan Mechner had sort of like gone through his discs and had some discs that were labeled Karateka Atari 8SEP85, Jordan's copy with cheat keys, and Jordan's copy, and there's music development discs. And so Kevin went through and read them out, posted them on Atari Age just recently. This is like, a couple days ago. And turns out the music development discs are Apple discs and have some source code on them. I think the idea is that they're, I forget what it stands for, but the SC Macro Assembler source files that were basically cross-compiling for the Atari. So it was compiled on the Apple II, but it's all 6502. So anyway, it's kind of neat to look through it and see, how these things were set up, and it's because this is breaking news, we don't really know exactly what's going to be found there, but there's a sort of a similar disk set for the Apple with cheat keys on it. So Jordan Mechner also released his development, his Karateka development disk with, it's basically, I think, before the copy protection went on and with some cheat keys installed to make it possible to play test it without having to run through the first level over and over and over again, that kind of stuff. And so you, on archive.org, you can play that, which has a couple of extra cheat keys. And I think there's a couple of differences in, like, the text that scrolls by and things like that. So we're hoping that there'll be something similar happening on the Atari version. So far, it looks like Kevin posted that Control-R advances to the next level. But I think, I don't know if this was here, but I think he was complaining that you can't move. So, you can see the next level, but he couldn't figure out how to run. So we'll see how this goes. I don't know, Jack, have you tried this at all?
No, I have not. But I'm anxious to do so. It looks like it could be fun. See where this gets us.
Great. Let's move on.
You finally qualified for the classic, the Grand Prix. Grand Prix by Activision, a video racing game you play on your Atari video computer system. Every video racing game till now was a trial run for Grand Prix. Grand Prix puts the feel of a Formula racer in your hands, the sound and fury of a real race in your head. But don't get carried away. It's only a game. Or is it? Grand Prix by Activision.
In this week's episode, we have a retro computing gift idea by the host, and for only the second time ever, and very possibly the last time after this tight ship, it is my choice to choose the gift, and that will be something that I actually hijacked out of the news section because I didn't have another gift idea. It is the AP40, a Bluetooth controller for iOS, Android, Mac, and PC. Well, that doesn't sound very retro, but they are kind of burying the lead on this project. It comes from a development company called 8BitDo, and they are currently on Kickstarter selling this joystick, this controller. It has the general shape of a Super Nintendo controller. It has all the same buttons, basically, as a PS2 controller. And it has the rainbow logo of the classic Apple. But, again, they're burying the lead. What they are really selling here that is of interest to an Apple II user is that this controller is wireless via Bluetooth, and it comes with, optionally, a receiver that plugs into the joystick port on an Apple II. So it converts all the signals from this controller via Bluetooth to joystick controllers used on an Apple II, which is just remarkable. I haven't tested it because it being on Kickstarter, it's not a shop. At least that's what Kickstarter says. And it is estimated to be delivered in January of 2017. However, this company does have a pretty good track record. This is, as I mentioned, the AP40 controller, and they have done previous models such as the AP30, surprisingly enough. And so I think this project has already been funded in its entirety. In the first 5 days, they met their goal of 16,000 American dollars or 125,000 Hong Kong dollars. You can get just the joystick, you can get just the receiver, or you can get both. However, there is also a limited edition model that comes with a little itty bitty stand for your joystick, optionally can be used for your tablet or other mobile device. And this stand looks like an Apple IIe, almost like something you would find from Charles Mangan of Retro Connector, a 3D printed one, or maybe even a sort of Raspberry Pi case like he sells. So I have ordered originally just the receiver because I have enough Bluetooth controllers around the house that I don't need another one. But then I thought if I want to review this for JuiceGS, I should probably get the whole kit and caboodle so I can give it a proper review, because the review for the receiver would be headline, does it work? Body, yes. Shortest story ever. And so I thought maybe I should actually review the controller itself. There is no Kickstarter reward level that lets you choose the whole package of the joystick, the receiver, and the limited edition stand. But if you email them, they can combine the rewards behind the scenes for you somehow. Regardless, I'm currently pledged at the $49 level, which is for just the receiver. If I want the receiver and the controller, that is $85 American, which is, in my opinion, not all that bad. This Kickstarter has gotten so much press. It's been on Gizmodo, The Verge, TechCrunch, Forbes. It's really ridiculous how much press it's getting, and it kind of surprises me that a company that I had never heard of and doesn't really seem to be well known in the Apple II community would just come out of nowhere with a very attractive piece of hardware for the Apple II. I mean, we're a small community. I thought we all knew each other, but we hadn't heard of this company. And it's also maybe that's why they're getting so much coverage, or maybe it's because it's on Kickstarter, because when Alex came out with the 4-play card for the Apple II, which lets you do 4 controllers on an Apple II and play Kaboom, which is a Bomberman clone, no big mainstream news story picked up that, but all of a sudden one single Bluetooth controller for the Apple II, and that gets all the coverage? Well, I suppose. It's advertised as working for the Apple IIc. I emailed them and I'm like, is it specifically that model or can I use it on my 2GS as well? And they said, yeah, it works on the 2GS. I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's sort of strange that you're selling it as for a specific model of Apple II. But anyway, I have been talking for a while, so I am looking forward to getting this when it ships in January, assuming that it does. Is anybody else in on this Kickstarter?
Not yet, but I intend to be.
Mm. Yeah. And I like how it's just another Bluetooth controller for your iOS or Android device. And with that plug-in, I can put it into my 2C or my GS and use it there as well. So I'm very tempted.
Yeah, this is cool. I have definitely seen it going by on the news feeds. I had no idea what this was. I just thought this was just like a 6-color controller, you know, on this, but I didn't know about the stand that looks like a 2 plus or an Apple II.
Thank you for that.
Not like a 2E.
Thank you for that correction.
but it looks very cool. And I certainly had no idea that it could actually plug into an Apple II. A 2E, 2C, 2GS, so thanks for pointing out this thing that I should have seen. I think I would guess that they call themselves 8-bit Do, but I don't know, because it does have a kind of Nintendo look to their logo.
I suppose that makes sense, too. I hadn't thought of that. Because I think the AP30 had a color scheme reminiscent of the original 8-bit Nintendo. So Nintendo, 8-bit Do. You're right. That makes sense.
Okay. So you got Karateka, I got 8-bit though.
Anybody else who wants to get in on this Kickstarter has until Wednesday, October 26th, 2016 at 10:58 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And now let's move on to the eBay auctions. We're starting with Carrington. Oh, he's not here. Earl? No, he's not here. Okay, third on the list, because we've run a tight ship here.
You know that people can't see the show notes they're looking at, right?
Which makes it all the funnier. Podcasting at its best. All right, Jack, what eBay auction do you have for us? Is this spelled correctly?
All right. This is spelled correctly, which means it's spelled incorrectly. So, Grand Prix. Our last episode, I mentioned an Atari 2600 knockoff of Grand Prix called Grand Prix, which is apparently some sort of Chinese or Taiwanese knockoff that somebody was trying to sell for the phenomenal sum of 4,500 euros. I did try and bid on this. I tried to bid $1, and my bid was rejected. And the seller listed it now as no longer available for some reason without an actual... Nobody paid 4,500 euros. I don't know why. But that version had a totally crazy label. That was the only sort of redeeming value. It had this crazy piece of art that was like a pen drawing of a weird racer guy and a woman in a prom dress and some explosions and the word crash, and just it was nuts. Someone else is also selling a different Grand Prix cartridge for the 2600 that has not that label. It has another different label, which is actually just a piece of the artwork from the original Grand Prix box art turned into the label for this cart. I don't know. This is crazy, but this one is only 7 euros is the buy it now price, so a lot more reasonable way to, but I really would have loved to see in my hand that crazy piece of art on the previous one.
Excellent.
Very cool. Well, with that.
Maybe we in our, you know, maybe our podcast will be inflating the market for the Grand Prix now.
Could be.
It does happen. Yeah. There is the RCR effect.
Yeah.
Well known RCR amongst bump. eBayers.
Yes. Yeah. Just under /dot effect, right? Mm. Actually, that's probably not even an effect anymore, is it?
/dot? Is that what you
used
said?
Used to be. I think of that as an effect in the early days of the web.
No, I remember when I started working at Computer World magazine back in 2007, that was our goal, was to get a story /dotted. And when we did, there was like a huge celebration. We got /dotted, woo! And then after that, it was dig. And when we got dug, that would put our servers under a strain. And now it's Google News. Yeah. Anyway, Michael, you're mimicking something on eBay today?
Oh, yes, I am. This is one of those strange peripherals from yesteryear. This is the Mimic System Spartan. Just in case you were unsure of whether a Commodore was better than an Apple or an Apple better than a Commodore, here's a peripheral to plug into your Commodore 64 to give you all the features of a Apple II Plus. Which is interesting because I would have taken the Commodore 64. But what got my attention on this eBay item that came up in one of my searches is I thought, that graphic, it looks familiar. And then I realized it was from, I'd seen it on the Apple Fritter website only last week. So I don't know what it is with some eBay people who go to all the trouble of getting some stock art or borrowing an image from somewhere else to put into their auction item. They've got a blurry photo of an actual insides. The current bid, 24 bids, up to $255 Canadian dollars. So yeah, it's interesting, it put me off when I saw the stock art in there, so it's not one that I'm going to bid on myself. I don't want to say there's anything strange going on with it, but always worries me when you're not actually seeing the actual shots of the device that they're asking you to bid on.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like I could sort of understand this if it were like 15 years ago or something, and it's hard to take a photo. Mm. But, I mean, everyone can take a photo very easily. It's very easy to... I mean, like, if you can get into the website to post your listing on eBay, you can get a photo in.
Oh, I actually find putting the photos in is the easy part of getting my listings up. And I don't know about the rest of the world, but here in Australia, if we put a posting up, we can put, I think, up to 12 photos in at no extra cost, unlike the bad old days where you could have, one photo and maybe a separate zoomed in iconic one for the listing side of things, and then you'd pay to put extra photos in. But these days you can load your listing with so many photos that it's quite easy to do, and that's one of the reasons I'm a little bit well, put off actually bidding on it. So
yeah, it's being sold by someone who's got no, you know, is new at this, has no feedback as a seller. But I it does. The other thing I think is that I find a little, I don't know, strange or worrying, is that the one shot, which I think might actually be of the thing that's being sold, has tape over the serial numbers on the power supply, which basically means like everything in this listing is designed for you not to be able to identify whether you're getting, like, what you're getting. Like, you can't, you wouldn't be able to show that the thing you got isn't the one in the pictures because there's tape over the identifying things. So I really don't know what the, I don't know what the seller's thinking.
The take is, no, yeah, I don't know what the take on this is. And I've bought stuff off people with zero feedback before. That's, you take your shots, you put your money down, and I won't say you hope for the best, but it's, you know, to me, it's the photo and also the lack of other photos, and as you pointed out, the blurring out of serial numbers on there, that it's just too many things. But you know, the thing is, it's, you do a little bit of Googling, and it's quite a nice device. And you know, I know people who would go out and get a Commodore 64 just so that they could use this plugin. And it's a great way of making a Commodore 64 look ugly, having this thing plugged into the back. But
make a Commodore 64 look ugly. That happened at the factory.
Oi, oi, oi. I like the styling of the Commodore 64, and I'm an Apple fan. I think it's a great little machine. I love playing with them. But, yeah, I would hardly call adding a Spartan on as enhancing a Commodore 64. It's sort of like,
no.
But it would bring you access to a whole lot of extra software and things. So, you know, I was torn between bidding on this one. I've got no problem. Okay, they don't ship to Australia, but that I can get round. If I had just a little bit more confidence level, I would be bidding on this one and talking about something else.
Yeah, it's a rare thing. I think I might have seen one sometime, you know, somewhat recently on eBay, but I mean, they really don't come by very often, and I don't think they sold very many. They had really horrible ads. They go around and search they see freakish clowns, but and the thing itself, for some reason, it just looks like some kind of like parasitic bug or something. but yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's an Apple II clone that uses a, you know, Commodore 64 is a keyboard, basically. So, very, very weird thing. And I guess, you know, every seller has got, you know, there was a point when they had zero feedback. So it's not, it, and I can almost see why you might at the very beginning be scared of eBay and, you know, don't want to put serial numbers out or, you know, anything. I could sort of almost understand doing this, but I think if I know that when I started on eBay selling things, my approach to this was basically, don't sell big items first. You know, sell a couple of things to get used to it that are not, that you don't mind if they don't go for a lot, because this is a big item, so it's kind of a big gamble. It almost might be worth the gamble to get it, but anyway, it's a cool thing.
Yeah, from the age of strange and cool peripherals.
And to close out our eBay auction, Paul, it looks like you have not one, not two, not three, not four. You're just going to take over the whole eBay section. Go for it.
I think you haven't listened recently.
Yeah, I was going to say, Paul's cut back for this episode.
Well, so the first thing actually is, like the first three I have listed in our show notes here are all kind of a set. It was kind of sparked off by a really pretty unusual appearance on eBay, which is a Lisa 1 Twiggy drive cage. So it has two Twiggy drives in it, and these are, so presumably most everybody listening to this knows how this all went, but there was the Lisa, this machine that predated the Mac, and the first edition of it had 5 1/4 floppies that were particularly unreliable. So they're kind of weird. They have a sort of extra notches in them and two access windows. So you can tell when you have it, when you're holding a Twiggy disk, because they're, because it's got too many notches and too many holes. So there was basically, I think they had a top head, you know, like they could read both sides of the disk, top head and bottom head, but they were on opposite sides of the spindle. And so that's what the two windows were for. But and come to think of it, I don't understand why they have windows on both top and bottom. But at any rate, so Twiggy, what Apple did when the Lisa 2 came out is basically said, we will for free swap out the Twiggy drives and swap out the faceplate and give you a Lisa 2. And so all of the Lisas that you ever see are Lisa 2s, and the Twiggy drives are super hard to find. So this is a cage that contains the two Twiggy drives that would have been in Lisa 1, and it is currently, it has 4 days, 5 days left, basically. So I think it might still be active by the time this gets posted. It is just about to hit $5,000 at 18 bids. So clearly people know that these are rare and unusual, and this kind of price is one that you might almost not expect that it's even going to be attempted to be used. This is a collector's price. But if you were trying to recreate an original Lisa, you can spend $5,000 on this. And then the next one, the next listing I had is for the bezel that they would have taken off the Lisa 1. So you can get a Lisa 1 bezel that has openings for the Twiggy drives. That's buy it now, $5,000. So we're already at about $10,000. And the Lisa 1 came with a mouse that was specific to the Lisa 1. I think it's possible that some of the Lisa 2s came with this mouse as well, but mostly the Lisa 2s, I think, came with what became later the Mac mouse, the MO100. So the Lisa mouse it's different. It's basically a little bit boxier, and it has a narrow rectangular button. And those are super rare, but there is one for a $3,000 buy it now. So if you want to spend whatever it is, $13,000, getting, you know, bringing your Lisa 2 back to its Lisa 1 roots, there's a couple of eBay auctions you can use to do that. So, anyone gonna do that?
I might just pass on these. A little bit too rich for me.
Yeah. It's kind of neat to see them, that they do kind of still exist, but, yeah, good grief.
Yeah, I think that, like, to me, it's hard to see. I mean, even something like Grammed Pricks for €4,500 is a game you could play. It's stupid to buy it. But, like, this is sort of like, I cannot imagine why someone would buy this for $5,000 just because it's rare. You know what I mean? It's sort of,
Well, maybe you could get it to work, you know? But
yeah.
But yeah, no, it's pretty, it's
pretty obscure,
pretty awful,
but cool to see though.
Yeah. I would love to have them, but I would have to have won the lottery several times to make it, to feel like it's okay to spend $13,000 doing that. Anyway. Okay, so yeah, I guess it took a while, but that was all one package. The other two things, so I think we've talked about this one before. It's the Microsi Havoc clone. So it's an Apple II, clone. They're pretty rare. Microsi was a company that made a lot of disk drives, I think is what they mainly know them for, but I think they also made some interface cards and things. And they made an Apple II clone, which is, I'm not sure if you can see it. Yeah, you can sort of see it in this picture. It's a really hilarious looking thing. So it's basically a disk drive that has a computer in it. And you plug the keyboard. It's a big, it looks like a disk drive with kind of like a fat part running around the middle. And the front of it is basically just where you put the disk, and you can plug in the keyboard to the side. And, you know, inside it's an Apple II clone. But it really, I don't know, I really kind of like the look of it. They're pretty rare, though.
Makes the Mimic look attractive.
I kind of like it.
To me, it's so ugly, it's actually cute.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, that could be it. I guess it took me a while.
Like a Volkswagen Bug, sort of. Just like, wow, it is so odd that it's kind of endearing.
Yeah. I saw one in person, actually, a couple of years ago. Someone had one at Kansas Fest. I did not. It was, you know, I didn't come home with it. But anyway, it's cool. If you haven't seen it, take a look at it because it's weird looking. This one. So here's another. I don't know if this is a inexperienced seller or what the deal is, but this actually, if you look at the see other items by this seller, this is listed twice. You have to kind of like work at it to figure it out. But so it kind of feels like this is a seller that doesn't know what they're doing. One of the listings is for $300 or best offer, and then one of them is under bid. I bet they don't actually have two. The photos are exactly the same. The current bid on the one that's under bid is at a dollar. So one of these listings has got to go down. In fact, hopefully by the time that you hear this, the buy it now one will be gone. Because otherwise, someone could pay for both and not get both. But anyway, right. Enough about that. The last thing I'll mention is the there's a PET. Where is it? Commodore PET 2001-8 that is for sale for a small. I guess everything I've picked is very expensive. $1,200. Buy it now. So this is for looking at the pictures, but it's actually really, it's a quite a complete set. And the 2001-8 is the one that has the actual sort of like, you know, cash register keys and the built-in cassette. You know, it's the original PET and it's in all its crazy glory. So, but it looks like it works. It has a lot of manuals. It has a lot of tapes. It's in excellent condition. So if you are somewhere near Orange, Connecticut, yeah, this might be of interest to you. That's it. Anyone going to get any of these things?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so. But they definitely look worth a look. But that Apple II clone, that is so tempting.
It's very cool. Yeah. Well, and particularly at the fact that it's at a $1 bid. I mean, like I bet it's going to go quite high. But
yeah, it's not going to be $1 for long.
Yeah,
that RCR bump.
Oh. Yeah, that's right. That's what it's going to be.
There's a couple of clone collectors that I know that probably will be upset that we're giving it airtime. But guys, tough.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on to the closing discussions for this week because we've prattled on quite long enough, I think. Let's see. I don't have anything to add, and it appears that Michael does not either. Is that true?
Well, no, there isn't really much to add apart from the fact that I'm enjoying getting on with the Retro Challenge and watching comments just pop up in my feed here.
I hope they're all kind.
I'm sure they are.
All right, what about you, Jack?
I went to a thing called Retro Gathering in Västerås, which is a town about an hour's drive west of Stockholm yesterday, and it was really cool. This is basically a video game themed little sort of conference. I don't know if it's a conference. What do you call it? It's an event. There were a whole bunch of people selling all kinds of retro video game items. So there were two big rooms full of basically just people selling stuff. There was a big hallway in between that had a lot of old systems set up. You could sit and play some games. A lot of the systems were things that I was familiar with. There were a few things that were pretty new to me. And there were some things that were just that I'd heard of and not seen much of, but got to play with, which was kind of fun. One thing that I rediscovered in my visit there was I played a little bit both on an Intellivision and a ColecoVision, which I had not touched in over 30 years, either of those. And I was reminded of just how terrible the controllers are on both of those. Oh, my God. What a nightmare. But
the Intellivision, isn't that the one that has like the little disc?
A little flat disc. But and that's not the problem, though. The problem is that the fire buttons are these little chiclet buttons on the sides of the controller. Oh, just awful. And the ColecoVision, it has a stick, but there the action buttons are kind of like bigger square buttons on the side, and just it was terrible. But fun to play with them anyway. And there was also a nice talk there from a guy named John Hare, who worked at Sensible Software, which made a lot of games like Sensible Soccer and Cannon Fodder. Like they were big in the Commodore space from the 80s up until the mid 90s. So it was cool. And they had the Swedish Championship Pong match, which apparently they do every year. I did not enter. I should have. I would have won that thing.
Of course.
Probably not, but I could have tried. Anyway, that's all I had. I had a good time.
Oh, is that all?
Yeah.
Okay. And Paul.
Cool. Well, let's see. So I had there are a couple of things. Actually, some of the things have to do with acquisitions that I have wound up with. But I lucked into a couple of things that were of interest. One was that somebody on Craigslist had listed one of those Bell & Howell Apple IIs, and it was clearly an old one, you know. So Bell & Howell had distributed these Apple IIs. They were black, and they had a Bell & Howell Apple co-branding badge. They're the oldest of them actually match the old Apple IIs in having a raised power light, so you can sort of tell they're from the first set, and this was one of those. So I contacted the seller and arranged it, went out and met with him, and it turned out it's actually so I think it's probably okay for me to say his name. So he was he's Peter Olivieri, who wrote. I knew his name from being a columnist for Soft Talk magazine. So he wrote I think it's Mind Your Business column, which ran through like much of the entire run of the magazine, I think. And he also was the editor for Wheels for the Mind, which was a Mac. It's basically Apple-sponsored Mac education publication that was run out of Boston College. So. So that was pretty cool. Actually, I had a chance to talk to him. He showed me in his garage, he had a bike that Steve Jobs gave him. But anyway, yeah, so I now got a really, really early Bell & Howell Apple II. It's serial number 431. So I'm kind of blown away by how old that is. But I also got from him a bunch of Wheels for the Mind issues that he had extra, and so I'm going to try to scan those, and because I'm not sure that I don't think they're all out there. So it's a publication that will soon be available, I suppose. So that was pretty wild, though. If somebody who I guess I probably should have kind of known was in the area because, you know, he was based at Boston College, as was Wheels for the Mind. But anyway, that was pretty fun. And I guess that's the main thing. Another TV note that came up, I think last time I mentioned, Commodores being on Mr. Robot and all over Halt and Catch Fire. Oregon Trail made it onto Blind Spot, an actual relatively mainstream television show, but one of the characters gave another of the characters a 5 1/4 Oregon Trail disc, which I was a little suspicious of initially, but I did find at least 3.5-inch discs with that same kind of design on. So maybe it was actually a real Oregon Trail disc, or maybe it was made relatively accurately. It is, I think, the VGA special PC edition. So anyway, if you missed that, it may not be worth watching Blind Spot just to see that, but at any rate, you could. And I think, I don't know, that may be about it for the notes.
I think that's quite enough. And on that note, that brings us to the end of episode number 138 of the Retro Computing Roundtable for Sunday, October 2nd, 2016. Oh no, we're back at the beginning. It's a Mobius podcast. So that is it for this show. You can find all the show notes for this episode and all episodes of the Retro Computing Roundtable at our website, which is rcrpodcast.com. You're welcome to engage with us, the hosts, in multiple forums, including the official forums found at the Vintage Computer Federation website, vcfed.org, on our Facebook group, which is facebook.com/group/RCRpodcast, or on Twitter at RCRpodcast. You can, of course, engage with us in a non-public medium by emailing us at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. A reminder that we are a member of the Throwback Network, where you can find multiple podcasts about the good old days of computers, technology, and pop culture. Find it at throwbacknetwork.net. We also encourage you to please leave us a review on iTunes. It not only strokes our egos, it also helps other retro computing enthusiasts find our show on iTunes. Thanks, algorithms. Until next time,
Retro Compute!